Welcome, friends, to another weekly edition of Economic Update, a program designed to present you with a whole host of economic realities facing us, jobs, incomes, debts, all of those dimensions of our lives and the lives of our families and our communities. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and I teach now at the New School University in New York City. Later in the program, we'll be catching up with our websites and some of our other activities, but I want right now to jump right into the economic updates that have been agitating readers and watchers and just plain folks over the last week or so. One of the biggest stories is the story of the fall of a leader of the legislature in New York, Sheldon Silver. In the lower house of the New York State Legislature, been in office for many, many, many years, and a chief power broker in Albany, the capital of New York, for most of that time. He's been arrested, he's been charged with a variety of crimes, basically having to do with abusing his office for personal financial gain. And there's much to do in the press in New York and the surrounding states about what he did or is alleged to have done. And again, it amounts to using his political office for financial gain. In all of the discussions about the personal tragedies and about the misuse of the money, the only reason I bother you with a few words about it is because of what is not said. And here's what's not said, but ought to be said all the time. What Mr. Silver has been arrested for, and we will see whether or not he's found guilty, what he's been arrested for is the normal way legislatures in this country work, both at the federal level and at the state level, and indeed at the municipal levels with city councils and so on as well. The game has various names, pay to play, payola, dozens. Used to be called things like bribery, used to be called influence peddling, and so on. What legislatures do, the laws they pass, the laws they don't pass, the laws they change, make a lot of money for some people. Those people spend a lot of money on the legislatures in order to get the results they want. Some of that spending is legal because the laws have been arranged to allow it. Campaign contributions, party contributions, lobbying, and so on. But some of it is also, and has always been, illegal. Money into the pocket, bribery, plain and simple. It's a mixture of both. If you can get by with the legal, you don't have to resort to the illegal. But your survival as a business depends on it. And so it is overwhelmingly businesses. Individual self-employed businesses, small businesses, medium businesses, and large businesses. The larger the business, the more money is thrown around, and typically the more power is wielded. You only have to find a legislator who's willing to take in order for you to be able to buy. It has led many people to argue that our system of government is the best democracy money can buy, with the emphasis on buying. This is, in short, a systemic problem. It's not a problem about this or that legislator. That's why, despite arresting some and jailing some and firing some and passing laws, we still have it year in and year out across the country in the legislatures of the states, the cities, and the federal government. This is a problem that is systemic, and unless and until we change the system, it is not going to go away. The tragedy is real needs are being unmet because the money is diverted in this game of pay to play. The bigger news, and more important than any of that, came out of Greece. and that deserves some real attention. Despite many predictions, the left-wing party, it's a coalition of left-wing groups in Greece, won the elections on the last Sunday of January. And they won the elections big. Given that Greece has many parties, their governments have typically been coalition governments. But this victory of the far left by the Syriza party in Greece was a real stunner. They came one seat short of capturing half the seats in the Greek parliament. That would be called in the United States an election that delivered a mandate, a powerful decision by the Greek people en masse in a national election to vote against the two traditional parties that have been governing Greece, one or the other of them, for 40 years, New Democracy and the Greek Socialist Party, alternating pretty much the way the Republicans and the Democrats do in the United States, or conservatives and Labour in Great Britain, and so on. But the Greek people have had it. Those two parties, who used to together get between two-thirds and three-quarters of the vote, together, could not get one-third of the vote. And where did the mass of the Greek people go when they left the traditional two parties, center-right, center-left? They went to the far left, not to the extreme right, but to the far left, for a radical change of direction. For those who think that conventional politics is permanent, this is a wake-up call. For those who think that in all the countries of the world, the two traditional parties have it all locked up, this is a sign that things may not be so quietly secure in their lockup as you may have imagined or hoped, as the case may be. So now we're going to have a new direction. In the first few days of the new government, that has become crystal clear. So I wanted to talk a little bit about what's being planned and where they're going and what's at stake. First, the Syriza party has long demanded, and its new finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, has made clear, as has Alexis Tsipras, their leader, that they want a 50% cut in the debts of the Greek government that are now debts to the European Central Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the European Union. A cut of 50% in their debt, so that the money they might have had to spend paying off a debt that should never have been contracted for can be used instead to deal with what they call the humanitarian crisis. The fact that over the last 5 years, Greek salaries on average have dropped by between 30 and 40%, depending exactly on how you count. That Greece has one of the worst unemployment rates in Europe, 26, 27%. That the young people below 30 have an unemployment rate of 60%, and so on and so on. The government wants to stop paying off the banks and take care of its people, put them back to work, return to them the pensions that have been cut, rebuild to the where it was before, their minimum wage level, and so on. They also immediately stopped an interesting thing. They stopped the selling of the governmental monopoly on public power, electric power. They're not going to privatize that. And they're not going to privatize their major port, Piraeus, either. That shows which direction they're going. They're going to reorder Greek society. That's a little vague still what exactly they mean by that, but the direction is clear. They really are going to help the middle and lower classes. That's their goal, and at the expense of the upper classes. That has not been a government commitment anywhere else in Europe, and it seems real in Greece, and so all eyes, not just Greek eyes, all eyes in Europe and beyond, are now focused on whether and how this commitment of a left-wing party that won a mandate in its national elections, whether and how that will be carried out. I only want to develop, in my remaining minutes of time for this, one dimension of this story that does not get the attention it ought to. Leading the frowns in Europe, unhappy with a left-wing party making those gains, unhappy with the direction this new government is taking, is the German government of Angela Merkel. They're the ones, high officials there, saying that the Greeks must pay all their debts, the Greeks must continue the austerity that has savaged their middle and lower classes on a scale unlike almost anything else in Europe. The Germans insisting. And so I thought it appropriate to remind everyone in this program of a moment earlier in German history that might make one wonder about what the Germans exactly are doing. It's 1953, over half a century ago. World War II is very much alive in everyone's memory, having only ended in 1945, 8 years earlier. The German government is desperately trying to rebuild from the devastation of World War II, and the German government is trying to do that while laboring under huge debts. Debts incurred in around World War I at the beginning of the century, and then debts incurred around World War II. Debts incurred by Adolf Hitler's government and other German governments before. And the Germans say to the creditors they have, French, British, and American banks, and the French, British, and American governments, look, we cannot rebuild from the devastation of the war. That might not have been an argument that meant too much to the French, British, and Americans, who after all had been Germany's enemies. But they made another argument that did work. You, they said to the British, French, and Americans, want us to be your ally in the Cold War against the Soviet Union. In order for us to do that, we have to be rebuilt, prosperous, give our workers jobs so that they can be convinced to be anti-Soviet. And here's what we want, the German government said. We want relief from the enormous burden of the debts we have to you, so that we can use the money to build our economy. If that sounds familiar to you, good, because pretty much that's what the Greeks have asked for. Only they're not asking as anyone's enemy, and they're not asking because they ever used money to wage war on anybody. They're asking because the debt prevents them from getting out from under a global capitalist crisis they did not cause, and a bailout that bypassed the majority of their people. They want now to get out from under. And who's objecting? The Germans. Well, let's see what the Germans got. In London, in August of 1953, Britain, France, and America and German representatives met. And after a year of effort, the Germans got what they wanted. Guess what? Half of Germany's debt, then numbering around $32 billion, half of that, $16 billion, was forgiven, written off. You never have to pay it, and the Germans never did. The other half was stretched out over 30 years so that it could be paid in very small increments. In other words, Germany was relieved of the overwhelming bulk of its foreign debt in order to rebuild its war-damaged economy, and to be an anti-Soviet ally. This same government does not want to permit the Greeks to do what it itself did. Please think about that as you listen to the rhetoric around making people pay their debts coming out of the German government and German officials. A short memory, and one that ought to make at least some people ashamed. Next update. I just want to congratulate a state senator in New Jersey by the name of Shirley Turner. Why? because she's put a bill into the New Jersey legislature that would prevent any money in a state pension fund maintained by New Jersey, mostly for its public employees, no money in such a pension fund, says her bill, should be invested in a company that moves abroad to escape paying taxes in the United States. How interesting an initiative to deal with a problem we've spoken about on this program more than a few times, and one that is long overdue for attention of all kinds. Hats off to Shirley Turner for having the courage to do so. And just coincidentally, or not, the European Union announced that its antitrust division is taking a long, hard, critical look at companies whose names you know, Amazon, Apple, and Starbucks, for abusing European hospitality by moving operations, some real, some just shell operations, to Luxembourg and cutting deals in Luxembourg to pay very little to that tiny country and thereby save the taxes that they were paying and should be paying to the country of origin, the United States, for Amazon, Apple, and Starbucks. They got all kinds of benefits in the United States, tax reductions, subsidies, loans, you name it. But they don't want to give back, do they? Public relations aside, they're looking to pay the least taxes possible, and they found a willing co-conspirator in Luxembourg. I want to turn now, as we do in the second segment of this program, to responding to issues and questions that you have sent me through the websites, which I'm glad to do, and it gives me a chance to remind everyone listening that we maintain two websites, rdwolf with two Fs, .com and democracyatwork.info. Both of those websites contain much of the kinds of material you hear on this radio program. The websites are available absolutely free of charge 24/7. I invite you to go there and make whatever use you can of them. We update them every day with all kinds of materials for your use. In addition, the two websites provide you with an opportunity to communicate to us, to pose questions for us to respond to make comments, criticisms, suggestions. We read every single one, and I thank you for delivering so many to us. We can't answer all your questions, again, because we get so many. We select the few based on how they relate to what a lot of you seem to be interested in. So going to either website will allow you to communicate to us, and likewise going to either website will allow you to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest, and so keep a closer contact with us if you would be interested, and we urgently and with pleasure invite you to do that. And finally, you can be a partner of this program by sharing what you learn here, portions of it, with others on your own social media, and that's a way to spread the message that is good for all of what we are trying to do. Okay, first question that I want to respond to. How exactly does Social Security work? And what's the story on whether it is or it isn't a fair and progressive tax system in this country? Well, let me answer as bluntly as I can. For the federal government in Washington, the Social Security tax, often called the payroll tax, brings in about 40-45% of the total money flowing into the federal government to enable it to do all the things it does. Roughly, the payroll tax brings in about what the income tax does. And these are very different taxes in terms of who they hit and how they hit. So let's talk about the Social Security or payroll tax. Everybody who earns income from a job, a wage or a salary, is subject to the payroll tax. This year, the payroll tax is levied on the first $118,500. In other words, if you earn $118,500 or less, every nickel you earn is subject to the same flat rate of tax. But as many of you have asked, and let me be crystal clear here, every dollar that you earn over $118,500 pays no Social Security tax. So the richer you are, the bigger the chunk of your payroll payments, wages, salaries, is free of the Social Security tax. Everybody pays on the every dollar up to $118,500. Any dollars above that that you earn in a year, you don't have to pay Social Security tax on. In other words, the tax isn't progressive, it's the opposite. It's regressive. The richer you are, above $118,500 a year, the smaller the percentage of your total income that you need to pay into Social Security. This leads, of course, to a question. Many people have pointed out that the Social Security system is now raising enough money and has enough money accumulated to pay the benefits it's supposed to, but only to the 2035 year, and that there might be some problems after that. To which one answer is, and that's why I've explained it the way I have today, one answer is get rid of what is called the Social Security cap. Why are we not taxing payroll tax for people who earn more than $118,500? Precisely because they're the most able to afford it. And why should they have been exempted in the first place? And if you did that, who would it affect? Well, here's the answer. We did the work. 6.1% of Americans earning wages and salaries earn more than $118,500. Less than 1 in 16 Americans earns more than $118,500. So if you raise the cap, it would mean a higher tax only on the richest 6%. They're the ones who would have to pay more if they stopped being given an exemption, even though they are the most able to pay. It's something to think about. And again, the Social Security tax, the payroll tax, is about as important as the federal income tax. But where the federal income tax, which we will talk about in another program, is progressive, the higher the income you get, the higher the percentage you pay, the payroll tax is flat, the same percentage for everybody, except for those wealthy ones, the 6% or so, who get more than $118,500, and they can stash away all that extra beyond $118,000 free of the payroll tax. The other question I want to respond to has to do with the notion of debt jubilee. I've always wanted to talk about this, and I have on occasion, but I want to get at it again. First, jubilee. Jubilee is an old religious concept. It exists in Christianity, but in many other religions too. And often it is thousands of years old. And it comes from an ancient time and an ancient idea that is finding new adherents all the time. Here's what Jubilee originally meant. That over time, communities discovered that some people, in the way they had organized their economic system, got richer and others got poorer. Often, this had really nothing to do with the efforts these people put into their work. It had to do with if your land got a lot of rain or it didn't, if there was a climate problem or there wasn't, if the animals rampaged across your fields but not those of your neighbor, if you got ill during the year and couldn't work at a key moment, etc., etc. Some people became richer and some people became poorer. And that set up tensions in the community that hadn't existed when everybody was roughly the same. Some a little better off, some a little worse, but no extremes. And so society said, we need to protect ourselves against extreme inequality. So every 10 years, every 20 years, every 50 years, it varied, they would redivide the land, which was the major resource at the time. Those who had a lot, had accumulated a lot, would lose some. Those who had lost a lot would gain some. Kind of everybody would start again. An equal playing field, a level playing field, recreated so that the community would be less destroyed and broken apart by extremes of wealth. One modern form of this idea is debt jubilee. The idea being, over time, some people become creditors, they lend a lot, and other people become debtors, and that creates tension and difference, which it surely does, and we should deal with that, the argument runs, we should deal with that by a debt jubilee. All debts canceled. Everybody who owes doesn't anymore. Everybody who's a creditor has no one owing him anything anymore. And I was asked to comment on this. I understand where this desire comes from. I understand what it's designed to deal with. But I don't think it's an effective way. And here's why. There are many reasons you go into debt. Sometimes you do it in order to develop a business, to produce more products, and it's a very good thing for society. Other times you borrow money just to have a blast and indulge yourself. We oughtn't to treat these things in the same way, and ditto for lenders. Moreover, it doesn't solve the problem. The reason jubilees had to come back every few years was because the basic system in the economy kept creating gaps between rich and poor. So for me, the far better way to go is to say honestly and clearly, let's change a system so it doesn't distribute the benefits and of output unequally. Then we won't have to fight about redistributing it. It's a fundamental systemic criticism of an economic system that says, let's not have a system that produces inequality in the first place, rather than fighting with one another about how to redistribute later. It's a simple logical argument, but it's very powerful in the lesson that it teaches. We've come to the end of the first half of this program, and a final thought today for this part of the program. The events in Greece are profound. They represent the rising up of a population, in this case, the Greek people, to make a fundamental change in the economic system they live with and the economic direction their society is going. It isn't just rhetoric about the middle class and the poor taking over. It's a reality. And it's a reality that teaches a profound lesson. Years ago, the Syriza party, not many years ago either, was getting 3-4% of the vote in Greek elections. And it was dismissed as representing a tiny group of people that the quote-unquote mainstream didn't have to worry about. Well, it turns out that after enough time passes and the mass of people begin to understand that the system in which they live has consigned them to a deteriorating economic situation, that being told, just wait, the hard times will pass, turns out to be a bad piece of advice because they don't pass. It turns out that those people can become politically organized. And as politically organized, they can contest for the power to shape what's happening to them in a way they couldn't before. Whatever happens in Greece, this is an upsurge of popular democratic power that deserves everyone's close attention.
This is all about rocking chair bottle on Murfreesboro. You want nothing special, but kind of fit me. Oh, here we go. I'm in old rocking chair. remind me of my pain. Has it robbed me?
Welcome back to the second half of today's Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff, and this is a program that spends its second half, as you know, I hope, by now, on dealing with a number of major economic issues in the news, and often we have a guest to interview, as we did the last 3 weeks, but today I will be going into a couple of topics that you have asked me to talk about by communicating to our websites, and so I want to do that. The first topic for today might be called, what's happening to union membership and what can we say about it? Well, the Bureau of Labor Statistics keeps a record. It has done that since 1983 about the percentage of people working who are either members of a union or represented by a union in bargaining with their employer over the wages they get, over the conditions of their jobs, and so on. The sad reality is that for 2014, the percentage of American workers represented by unions has dropped again. And it is now at a historic low, barely above 11%, and I wanted to talk about that. Back in 1983, when the Bureau of Labor Statistics first began collecting these numbers, the membership of unions, the number of people in unions, was 20.1%. By 2004, 20 years later, it had dropped to 12.5%, and it has fallen further since then. In the private sector, and this I want to underscore, in the private sector of the United States, which is the largest sector, most people employed in the United States are employed by a private employer, not by the federal, state, or local governments. In that private sector that dominates our economy, the percentage of workers employed by a union is currently 6.6%. That's right. Over 93% of private employees in the United States have no union, are not represented by a union. And I want to drive home as sharply as I know how that the next time you hear a representative, a senator, a politician, an academic, a businessman or woman who should know better and probably does, talk about big labor, you should scratch your head and wonder, what are they talking about? Unions have been on a 50-year decline. An institution that represents 6% of the workforce and cannot represent 93% of the workforce isn't a powerful institution, especially if 30 or 40 years ago it was much, 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 much larger. It means it's an institution that is now small and has been declining, literally advertising to its adversary business that they need not be worried about anymore. And it shows. It shows in the weakness of union activity. It shows in the lack of knowledge about unions, their history, their capabilities, that is so widespread in our population. The results of a weak union movement are also showing up in our weak real wage story. The fact that over the last 30 years, the real wages, that is the amount of money you get adjusted for the prices you have to pay, is stagnant, hasn't gone up. In the previous 30 years before that, it had gone up, And it's not a coincidence that when unions were much stronger, their real wages rose, and when unions are much weaker, they don't. So the consequences for people in and out of unions, it has been serious. Do unions still matter in certain places and industries? Yes, they do. In New York State, unions are strong relative to, say, North and South Carolina. In New York State, 25% of workers are represented by unions. In North and South Carolina, 2 or 3% of workers are represented by unions. So it varies by state. It varies from one industry to another. But it's a serious issue. Why are unions weak? Well, one factor, and an important one, has to do with the opposition of business. They don't like to deal with unions. Business likes to have the employer dealing with each worker individually, because then it's the power of the employer, of the staff, of the managers, of the shareholders, and all the wealth they have on the one hand, and a single individual worker on the other. That's a fight between, if you pardon me, David and Goliath, except David doesn't have a slingshot. So the idea of unions has always been workers will begin to level the playing field if they can get together, bargain as a group, bargain collectively, so they have some way to counter the massive power and wealth of their employers. So businesses don't want that. They know they have the employee in all the senses of that term if he or she is isolated, not in a union. So yes, businesses try to undermine, restrict, contain, destroy unions. That's not new. That's been true throughout the history of the United States and of other capitalist countries. The opposition against workers getting together is a systemic feature of capitalism and ought to be appreciated as such. But what else makes unions weaker? Well, one enormously important factor that really took off in the 60s and 70s and ever since has been the exodus of union jobs. Precisely in those industries where unions were powerful and successful in driving up wages, taking workers and bringing them into the vaunted American middle class, precisely the success of the unions in our capitalist system increased the incentive to employers in those industries to escape from paying good wages by moving production to Asia, Africa, Latin America, where they could get away with paying much less. The peculiar way capitalism as a system works is this. Workers try to improve their well-being, to get more wages so they can live a decent life, send their kids to college, so-called American dream. But the very success that unionized workers had in doing what they were encouraged to do in this society led their employer to leave. And when the employers left, when the auto companies left Detroit, when the steel companies left Pittsburgh, and so on, they not only took the jobs elsewhere, they not only took the money elsewhere, they not only drove those cities into fiscal disaster, but they also decimated those unions, deprived those union members of jobs, meant that those unions could no longer collect the dues needed to run a union. The unions have been crippled by the exodus of jobs, and that continues. And finally, unions have been hurt by their own strategies, by who they organized and who they didn't, by who they allied with in the larger community and who they didn't ally with, by their ability to shape the consciousness of the American people, to be friendly to working folks, to the efforts of working folks to get together, as opposed to being shaped by the influence of business lobbies and the politicians and the academics on the payroll of the business lobbies. And one of the things unions didn't do was deal directly with that problem of work exodus, jobs leaving. And here's where a strategy that has become more and more interesting once again stares unions in the face. What would happen if unions said to companies that are preparing to leave, go, goodbye, have a nice trip, but we're going to stay here, we the union, and we're going to keep working here, and we're going to go to the government and to the politicians to help us convert this business into a co-op owned and operated by us, the workers, who stay here. And when you move to China or India or Brazil or wherever you go, and you think you're going to bring that product back here and sell it to the American people, we have news for you. We'll be out there selling what we produce here in the factories you abandoned, in the stores you abandoned. And our appeal to our fellow American citizens will be, well, you can buy from the company that abandoned this country, or you can buy from those of us, your fellow citizens, who still work here. You might see a very different economic history of this country if you moved in that direction. The last big topic we have time for today, and if we don't finish, we'll continue next week, has to do with a question about revolutions. And I want to deal with that right head on, because more and more of you are writing about revolution, which I find very interesting in terms of what it suggests about what's coming into the consciousness of people these days as our economic system continues to work very well for the top 5%, and not so much for the rest of us. Revolutions in history have overthrown systems that people couldn't stand anymore. Slavery was overthrown. Here in the United States, we had a civil war, which was the form of the revolution, which overthrew slavery, made slavery illegal, as it is now written in that amendment of our Constitution. Feudalism, the system that existed for 1,000 years or more in Europe, with lords and serfs, that was overthrown by a revolution, one we celebrate called the French Revolution of 1789. And finally, capitalism faced a revolution in 1917 in Russia, in 1949 in China, and so on. A revolution in which people calling themselves socialists said, we can't stand capitalism anymore, and we're building another system. In the case of slavery, feudalism, and capitalism, passions were raised. These revolutions were thought to usher in, by their leaders and by their followers, a realm of freedom, of democracy, of human liberation. And in the name of those things, those revolutions were carried out. People rallied to that cause, hoping for that liberation and freedom. But it didn't come. Sure, did people get a better life? Absolutely. Slaves were freed. Serfs were freed. And in the revolutions against capitalism, people's education and medical care and housing were provided as a matter of right, something which still doesn't exist where private capitalism is dominant. So advances were made, make no mistake. But the promises, the hopes of human liberation and freedom were not realized. And that has made large numbers of people skeptical about the very idea of revolution. Made people imagine that human liberation was an unachievable goal, something you dream about but do not mistake for an achievable reality. And I would like to talk to you about that in our remaining time. What happened in the revolutions against slavery, feudalism, and capitalism? Let's take a look. When the slaves were freed, the relationship master and slave was destroyed. In the United States Civil War, it was made illegal. Abraham Lincoln liberated the slaves. And there will be no more slavery in the United States, etc., etc. This was spectacular. This was a real freedom. This was an advance in human history. Slavery has been basically outlawed, with some notable exceptions, ever since. But was the slave liberated? Here's the irony. Yes, but also no. Weren't a slave anymore, yes. But no, you weren't liberated, because in many cases, for example, here in the United States, the slave, no longer a slave, now free, looked around and discovered that he or she, in order to live, had to become somebody's employee, had to get a job. And in the relationship of employee to employer, these folks, these ex-slaves, discovered that human liberation and freedom were not available. They had to do what in their new position as an employee? They had to come to work 5 days a week. They had to pour their brains and muscles into a job. And the employer paid them less than the value of what those workers produced, because the difference between what the employer paid the worker and what the worker produced, we call that value added by the worker through his or her labor, what the worker produced was worth more than what the employer paid the worker, which is how the capitalist system works. The employer is in it for the profit, which honest employers will tell you. They know they're getting more from those workers than they pay for, because that's where the profit comes from. So the slaves discovered that they were now in a capitalist system, and that while that was an advance, it wasn't the liberation that they had imagined. Same thing for the feudal serf, tied to the land, subject to the landlord, from 500 AD to at least 1600, 1700 in Europe, feudalism is the dominant system. And eventually, the serfs rise up. They can't stand it. Took them 1,000 years in Europe. And in 1789, in the French Revolution, what were the slogans? Liberty, equality, fraternity. Liberté, égalité, fraternité in French. That's what those peasants wanted. Not just better food and shelter, that for sure, but also liberty, equality, and brotherhood. Well, they got the revolution. They overthrew feudalism. No more serfs tied to the land. People were free. No more landlord dictating what happened all the time. But they also got capitalism. And they discovered, the ex-serfs, that they were now employees and subject to the same lack of liberation that they had hoped for, that I spoke earlier about in terms of the slaves. They were stuck in a capitalist system. Well, now let's finish the story. In 1917, the Soviet Union is born in a revolution against capitalism, the system of employers and employees, they thought. And they too spoke about freedom, equality, liberty, brotherhood, all of that, again, like the revolutions against slavery, like the revolutions against feudalism. And what did they achieve? An advance for the Russian people? Of course there was an advance. In 1917, Russia was one of the poorest, most backward countries in Europe. 50 years later, after this revolution had settled in, the Soviet Union was the world's second superpower after only the United States. They had become a modern, powerful, industrial country. Their revolution had achieved a lot. But did it achieve liberty, equality, fraternity, and all of that? Unquestionably not. So unquestionably not that in 1989, the Russian people had had enough of this and went back to private capitalism. Well, what had happened was in the Soviet Union, and this is similar to what happened in other parts of what we used to call the actually existing socialist world, you had gotten rid of the private employer, but you had substituted the government employer. Instead of a board of directors of your company elected by the shareholders, you had a board of directors, whatever the name, selected by the governing Communist Party or the government. You had a state official taking your product after you produced it, rather than a private person. For most people in actually existing socialist countries, they still went to work 9 to 5, 5 days a week, and produced more than they got in the way of wages and salaries. So they were in a state capitalist system rather than a private capitalist system. But free of capitalism, they hadn't become. Now, is the lesson here is the lesson we want to learn that you can't have a revolution that achieves liberty, equality, and brotherhood? Not at all. The lesson here is that the great revolutions of the past against slavery, against feudalism, and against capitalism all made advances for the human community, but they all also missed something. And they all missed the same thing. And the important lesson for those thinking about revolution in the world today is to make sure they don't miss the lesson of the past, that revolution is possible, that revolution makes gains, but also that the gains made by the past revolutions missed something that can't afford to be missed again. What is it? In a nutshell, here it is. If you want to make a serious run at liberty, equality, and brotherhood, you have to organize the production process so that those values are in it. And that means you can't have some people producing more than they get back while other people get that extra without participating in producing it. The problem of slavery is that the slave produces a lot, the master gives the slave back relatively little, and keeps the rest for himself and to keep his system going. The problem with feudalism was that the serf produced more than he got to keep, and that extra was given to the lord for his lifestyle. And the problem of capitalism is that when you go to work, you produce more than you get in a wage or salary. And that extra is the profit of the businesses, which they use to maintain their lifestyle, build their power, control the government, and so on. If you want that to change, you've got to change the organization of production. And the way to do that is to democratize it, to say that all production will be organized so that the workers who together produce it together decide what is done with the surplus or the profits they produce. Not some people get the profits while other people produce them. Not some people become wildly rich while everybody else is struggling to make ends meet. The minute you do that, you block the revolution from achieving the liberty, equality, and fraternity that was hoped for. This is not an impossible dream. Let me conclude by showing you why. In feudalism that lasted for 1,000 years in Europe, slowly, some manors, that's what they were called, where lords lived and serfs produced for them, some manors discovered over time small businesses arising. Serfs who ran away to a town would set up a little business. And they would arrange with other serfs who came later, hey, I have an idea. You work for me. I'll give you some money, and what you produce is mine. To make a long story short, inside of feudalism, little bits of capitalism began to grow. It was partly the breakdown of feudalism that enabled capitalist enterprises to get going, and eventually they got big, and eventually they contested and overthrew feudalism. In modern capitalism, worker co-ops places where workers democratize the enterprise. They reject shareholders. They reject a board of directors of other people. They run the business themselves democratically. That's also developing all over the world, not just in Mondragon, Spain, not just in a collective of little businesses here or there. You know from this program, I talk about it a lot. Those worker co-ops are the beginnings of a mass change, just like the little capitalist enterprises that grew up in the middle of feudal Europe were the beginning of what eventually blew up in the French Revolution as the end of feudalism. Think about it. Change is happening. It's a question of recognizing it, understanding it, and developing where it can go. Revolution has been a dream of human beings for thousands of years, something that survives in the consciousness of desire of human beings is a very profound reality. Making it real is the agenda of the human race, just like working out of slavery, working out of feudalism, and working out of capitalism has been. Thank you very much for spending this hour with me. I appreciate your interest. I appreciate your emails. Make use of our websites, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. I look forward to being with you again next week.
Gonna be my time, babe. They ain't gonna change. Change.